Hello and welcome to The Rest is History. Tom, we're just about to depart, aren't we, to Dublin for the latest in our series of international adventures.
Yes, very much looking forward to that because we both very much have a soft spot in our hearts for Dublin, do we not?
Well, actually, no, I don't know.
You don't like it?
It's not as good as Cork.
And would that in some way reflect your marital connections, Dominic?
Well, and I mean, Cork people have a very low opinion of Dublin.
But have you inherited this from Catherine? Careful what you say, bearing in mind that
we're going to Dublin.
Going to Dublin.
Yeah, I suppose I think it's fair to say I think they're both great, but Cork is even greater. Maybe that's the way I'd put it.
I won a T-shirt in Dublin.
Did you?
For my knowledge of Ulysses.
Oh, golly, well done.
I went on a pub quiz around all the pubs mentioned in Ulysses, and there were questions in each pub. I got the whole lot right.
Oh, Tom, how unlike you to boast about it on The Rest is History.
But I thought, what a great city.
Yeah.
You know, you win a T-shirt for knowing general knowledge about great novels.
Yeah.
I think that's tremendous. I like that.
So we're going to do a live show, but we're also going to record some episodes about Irish history in Dublin, aren't we? So we're very excited about that. We're going to be recording in the General Post Office, the location of the Easter Rising in 1916.
But not the only one.
Not the only post office or not the only location.
Not the only location of the Easter Rising.
No, not the only location. So Tom, you've been really boning up on Irish history in the last 2 days, haven't you?
So basically my knowledge of Easter Rising and all the build up to that does pretty much come from Joyce and a little bit of Yeats, but basically from Joyce. So I have Charles Stuart Parnell.
Yeah.
How do you think you pronounce his name?
Parnell.
It's Parnell. Yeah, it is Parnell.
So, Parnell.
So I've been slightly tense about this because I know that English people coming over and talking about Irish history on topics they haven't particularly mugged up on always goes down well with Irish listeners.
They love it.
So Dominic, you'll back me up here, won't you, that I have been a bit nervous about it?
You have been a bit nervous. You've been over-anxious, I think, about it. You've basically attempted, in the last sort of 4 days, you've attempted to do your to establish your own parallel career as an Irish specialist. So when you keep texting me and saying, I don't know anything about the 1880s, and I sort of say to you, but Tom, you don't need to know. We've got an expert coming on to tell us about it. But you're determined to cram a lifetime of scholarship into 3 days of preparation.
Yeah, but not even 3 days. Because you said, I also had to read an entire book on the Freemasons. Yeah. And an entire weekend of sporting activity.
Right.
So I was a bit tense about that because I blocked that because I went to see, I went to Villa Park on Saturday and then I played cricket yesterday. So not huge opportunities. However, to get to Villa Park, I had to drive up to Birmingham.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe I'll listen to some podcasts. And I came across this excellent, excellent series of lectures by Professor Michael Laffan. Have you heard of him?
Oh, well, I have now because you've been...
The Irish Revolution, historyhub.ie. I mean, we shouldn't be promoting other podcasts, but it's not really a podcast. It's a collection of 10 lectures. And apparently he'd give these lectures every year and they're absolute classics. Anyway, they're superb. I listened to the whole lot.
Crikey.
And it was like listening to the most addictive kind of audiobook.
Wow. That's high praise.
Yeah. I found the cricket kind of a frustration. I just wanted to... I wanted to find out what was happening. It's absolutely super. He's really good, very balanced, and very kind of very dry wit, and very excellent character sketches. So basically, if somebody's a wanker, he's going to call him a wanker.
Right.
Very refreshing.
Talking of such things, you told me that the thing you liked best about it was the British didn't come out as badly as usual.
They didn't come out as badly as I'd thought. I mean, I thought the British had behaved tremendously badly, because that's very much the impression one gets. Actually, I was fascinated and a little bit relieved to discover it was a bit more complicated than that.
That's refreshing on this podcast, because I think we're too hard on Britain sometimes.
Well, again, I'm sure Irish listeners will be thrilled to know that this is the perspective we'll be bringing to the story of the Easter Rising.
I should stress we are having an expert from Dublin who's coming on to explain the whole story to us and to talk us through it. And we're quite excited about that because we've been spending a lot of time planning it, haven't we? And afterwards, we're going with him to the pub, which we're particularly looking forward to.
Yes. And we've also got Dan Jackson, very much friend of the show, who will be coming on talking about basically the theme of his doctoral thesis, which is pretty much the British perspective on it all.
Yeah. So I didn't know that Dan had this specialism, because I knew Dan because of his brilliant book about Northumbria, the Northumbrians it's called, isn't it? About the Northeast. And he came on to talk about the North-South Divide on The Rest is History, and he came on to talk about the birth of the railways. But then I was really surprised, actually, to discover that he had this secret niche interest in his PhD, and in fact, his first book, an academic book, which was all about this, what I've always thought is one of the most fascinating periods in British history. It's those years just before the First World War, often romanticized as a lost golden age, but actually a period when everything seems to be unraveling and, you know, talk of civil war, mutinies, gun running.
So Professor Laffan described it as the most convulsive period in British politics since the civil wars.
I'm sure that's true. I think that probably is true, Tom. I mean, there is a point, isn't there, in 1910 to 1914, where people think there might be some kind of...
Well, he quoted this extraordinary passage from Asquith, and stop me if this is very well known, because it's not a period I know about at all. Well, Asquith, 6 months into the Great War, talks about the outbreak of war as a slice of luck, because it stopped Britain disintegrating into civil war.
Well, there's that famous...
Over Ulster and everything.
I don't think there would have been war in Britain itself, although maybe Dan will correct me. But I think there was definitely a high risk of civil war on the island of Ireland. And I think there's that famous bit where Churchill is looking back on the coming of, I think it's in the World Crisis or something like that. He's looking back on the coming of the First World War. And he has that thing about the dreary...
steeples of Fermanagh and...
Yeah, Tyrone, fading as people suddenly hear the news from, you know, Sarajevo or whatever. And the fact that they are preoccupied with that, so preoccupied actually that they slightly miss the bigger issue of what's going on in the Balkans.
But except that, you know, just to reiterate, Asquith doesn't see that. I mean, he sees, in a way, the First World, the Great War as peripheral to the crisis in Ireland.
Yeah, or peripheral to his own career of interfering with his daughter's friends.
And being a terrible war leader.
Yeah, reading classic novels middle of the afternoon when he should be chairing committee. I think Asquith is great, actually. I think Asquith is...
Okay, well, he doesn't come out well from Professor Laffan's lectures.
Does he not? I think he gets a bad press, actually, Asquith. You see, I'm very much on Team Asquith rather than Team Lloyd George in the liberal split.
No, I think I'm Team Lloyd George.
Are you?
Yeah.
On the basis of his Irish policy or what? Or
more energetic, Dominic.
More energetic in every sense, though, Tom.
Yes.
Not always in a good way.
But, you know, energy to spare.
Right.
Running the Great War rather than reading novels.
Feathering his nest, molesting his colleagues' wives.
And Bona Law,
the
Canadian offspring of
the
Ulster
Scott.
Presbyterian.
Yeah. Is he a Scot or is he Ulster Presbyterian?
Maybe he's Scottish Presbyterian. No, I think Ulster Presbyterian. I need to go back and listen to Professor Laffan.
You do, but I can do some live research if you like, Tom.
But so Professor Laffan
was a Scottish. It was both. Both were both
Scottish
right.
And Ulster. So he said about him, and I feel that I'm doing the podcast ahead of time because I'd like to discuss this with Dan, see whether he agrees with it. But he said of Bona Law, who basically was fomenting civil war.
Yeah, the Tories absolutely were. Yeah,
said he was the most radical leader of a British political party of all time.
Great.
And this was before. He's given this lecture before Corbyn became leader of the Labour Party.
Right.
But I would say that would still hold.
Because of his...
Well, I mean, to foment a civil war.
So in his recent book, The Age of Decadence, I think it's called, Simon Heffer, who you would think of as a very, trenchant commentator on Irish affairs, actually, he's incredibly damning about the Tories in the Edwardian period and says they're completely irresponsible. You know, exactly that, encouraging sectarianism, encouraging civil war, all this stuff.
Although I gather that they behaved slightly more responsibly in the last few decades of the 19th century.
Well,
they went around shooting grievances, getting rid of grievances. Anyway, listen, we're being told off by Theo.
Theo says, why are you in a blundering, amateurish way trying to do the Irish podcast before we even get to Ireland?
Well, it's because it's so interesting. And I hadn't realized how interesting it was because I'd never read about it, really.
Right.
And it's all I can think about. Anyway, however, let's move on.
Yeah.
So, two things that Theo has flagged up.
Yeah, he wants me to ask you, first of all, about Scotland's place in the Roman world. So there's been a story on the BBC website. It's a commonly held view that Romans didn't spend a long time in Scotland or have much interest in it. But, Tom, new research is highlighting the extraordinary extent of what they built. The extraordinary is a big claim. And their persistence in trying to subdue the Caledonian tribes. And this is all down to Dr. Andrew Tibbs, an honorary research fellow in archaeology at Durham University, who has surveyed all these sites. He thinks for the Romans, campaigning in Scotland was prestigious. Emperors were keen to do it. It was a war zone. It was comparable to what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. So I think one thing is fair to say is that Dr. Andrew Tibbs can never be accused of underselling his research. Tom, do you find this persuasive?
Well, Dr. Andrew Tibbs is a tremendous man. He is on Twitter as Roman Scotland, and he's produced an absolutely brilliant book that basically details, I mean, even places that the Romans didn't go is in his book. There is, you know, if there's a hint of a possibility the Romans might have gone there, he puts it in.
Right.
I talked about going to Melrose, which is indisputably one of the kind of the centres of the Roman occupation in Scotland. And I took his guidebook with me, and it was wonderful. I mean, there wasn't a hint of a kind of a ditch that he doesn't right. cover. So so his research is indeed groundbreaking,
right,
and fascinating. And it highlights the way in which the Roman presence in Scotland was basically the Romans are moving northwards. They land in AD 43. They're moving upwards, northwards, and they don't really have a sense of how long Britain is.
No.
And it's only with Agricola who wins this great battle at Mons Graupius. Nobody's entirely sure where it is, but it's kind of quite a long way up Scotland on the eastern side. And then he sends a fleet to circumnavigate the whole of Scotland. So they know then that it's an island. And back in Rome, Domitian, who's the emperor, proclaims that the whole of Britain has been occupied. And this is seen as a great feather in the cap, not just of Rome, but of the Flavian dynasty.
Yeah.
Because Vespasian, who was Domitian's father, had led legion as part of the invasion. He'd famously stormed Maiden Castle in southern Britain. And so the fact that Domitian was able to proclaim that he conquered the whole of Britain was a kind of wonderful thing for him to do. But then the frontier on the Danube collapses, and it looks as though the Balkan occupation may completely disintegrate. That is more important, obviously, because it threatens Roman control of the whole empire, basically. So a legion that had occupied, they'd built a base in Scotland just above the Firth of Forth, that's abandoned. They take all their nails and metal and bury them so that the barbarians won't be able to take them and forge them into swords. And they go off and fight in the Danube. They do that essentially because they see Caledonia, Scotland, as not really being worth occupying. They've gone up there now, and it's just the kind of barren place of midges and mists and kind of awful. But they are aware that, you know, it's a field for would-be ambitious emperors to go and conquer. So Septimus Severus, emperor in the early 3rd century, launches a pretty much a genocidal campaign from York. And he, you know, that's where he dies. Mm-hmm. And the temptation to pacify Scotland is always there.
Okay. So do you think Dr. Andrew Tibbs' claims that it's a war zone and it's comparable to what's happening in Ukraine are borne out?
I think the Romans always feel that they have the right to pacify anywhere they want. They don't have a word for frontier.
Yeah.
So they have no conception.
Hold on, what are the limes then?
They are kind of zones that have military infrastructure, but it doesn't imply that that's a frontier.
Okay.
So Hadrian's Wall, for instance, is not a frontier.
Yeah.
It's a marker. It's a statement to the barbarians that they're not worth bothering with. But if they want to, it doesn't mean that they kind of recognize the sovereignty of what lies beyond it. Notions of sovereignty like that are not something that the Romans would have recognized. So I guess that would be an obvious difference, is that the Ukrainians are fighting to defend their sovereignty.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, Russia is the third Rome, so behaving in rather Roman fashion there.
In their own minds, anyway. Yes, okay.
The other story that Theo's flagged up for us is an article that you retweeted, written by very much a friend of the show, James Marriott, who I think everyone would agree is the country's best podcast reviewer, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he's one of the best.
Probably the world's, I would say.
Probably the world's leading podcast reviewer.
Yes.
And one of the best reviewers of anything I think that's ever lived.
Ever. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, he has written about the collapse in humanities degrees over the last 10 years. It's extremely depressing. In English and history, student numbers have fallen by a third, in foreign languages by almost 40%.
Yeah.
So what's your feeling on that?
Well, I was quoted in his article as saying something that I've long believed, that the future for English, which I know you read at university, lies in one of two directions in the long run in general, either to be the new classics of the 21st century, or to be woke studies. A lot of people roll their eyes at me saying that. But of course, English, because of the influence of critical theory on English teaching, is already absolutely obsessed with
kind of... all the kind of the Foucault and Derrida and everything came
But ever via, since that, yeah. And now it's the decoloniser. I mean, most university English departments in Britain have sort of, in inverted commas, I hate the phrase, but they've decolonised their curriculum. They've taken off a lot of authors they think are politically incorrect and put on a lot of others. So English has gone down that road a lot. The big issue for English, as for history, is the complete collapse in their numbers. So that's not just, people often think that's just in Britain. They say, well, it's because the government's desperate to encourage science, technology, engineering and maths, which is the case in Britain. But actually, it's also mirrored in the United States, where I think for history, the situation is even worse. In fact, I think far worse statistically. And actually, I think there are a couple of things. One is that since the invention of the internet, you don't have to do an English or history degree to inform yourself. So I think they previously functioned as portals. You know, if you wanted access to this kind of higher learning, you had to do the degree, because otherwise you wouldn't get the reading lists. You wouldn't get all this information. Now, you were just saying about listening to that the Irish chap's lectures. You couldn't have done that, Tom.
No, I know.
20 years ago.
No.
Now you can. You don't need to go to, you didn't, you know, those were lectures to students. You've listened to them without registering at his university.
Right.
So there's that. But also, I think there's a cultural turn away from, you know, the
prestige of the old.
Prestige of the old, the culture of the book. You know, there were lots of quotes in James Merritt's article of people saying, you know, there was a time when you would expect your students to have read or to be very enthusiastic to read Middlemarch, let's say, or Ulysses. So there's an academic quoted in the James Merritt's Times article, an academic, Tom, not a million miles away, I think it's fair to say, from this podcast, mm-hmm. who is the head of, I remember James Merritt described this academic as the head of a big department at a Midlands University or something like that, who says, mm-hmm. I used to teach Ulysses to my students. I wouldn't even begin to bother now because...
Is there someone from Cork?
I absolutely wouldn't know, because they wouldn't read it. They don't have time. They don't have the attention span. They don't have the...
But that goes back to what you were saying about it, about the one thing that English could do is to go the classics route.
Yeah.
And actually the whole point of it is that it's hard.
Well, that's how I would do it.
So you chuck in Beowulf, Piers Plowman.
I would say it's hard, and it's now a really prestigious degree because it's hard.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how I do
think,
it.
I think basically that if degrees are serving up what people want, then it's not particularly hard, is it?
But Tom, then you have to face the consequences of that. The consequences of that are dramatically reduced numbers of students, redundancies for academics, and then a lot of people who've done their PhDs thinking they're going to get academic jobs, finding there are no jobs for them.
But Dominic, it's like sport. At the elite level, only a very few can reach it.
That's, well, it's very easy for you to say this on this podcast. I think it's much harder for you to say that if you're at a meeting of like your university colleagues.
Yeah, sure. But you know, I know all about elite sport. I know, right. I've been there.
Right.
It's tough. You've got to put in the hard yards.
This is exactly the
I mean, I think the risk for humanities is that if they surrender too much to fashion moves on.
Of course. Yeah.
So
course.
The problem with both English and history is that what seemed cutting edge 10 years ago now seems hopelessly reactionary.
Right.
And so it gets a kind of competitive spiral whereby each new generation of scholar has to demonstrate his or her credentials by going ever further in whatever fashionable direction, you know, scholarly opinion is taking them.
Yeah.
And so it becomes very, very, as I say, fashion driven.
But also, I think it loses prestige. So,
Yes, it does, of course.
The claim that's often made, well, English degrees, they should actually be studying The Wire and TikTok and whatever. I mean, actually, The Wire is dated now, but they should be studying the content of tweets or something. Well, I mean, that's fine.
That's what everyone does anyway.
But that's fine. But you cannot then claim that when your students come out, they will have the same level of status, I suppose, with employers as they would have done previously.
Yeah.
Anyway, these are very deep waters. And I'm sure a lot of academics who do listen to this podcast will be rolling their eyes at anything that you and I have to say about it, because, of course, we don't really have skin in the game.
No.
But I think it is sad that English and history, which we once, I mean, when we were at university or at school, we would have considered them the kind of canonical subjects. They've become very, very marginal.
I mean, the whole thing is that the idea of a canon is now problematic. People don't like canons. People, you know, people have decolonized canons and deconstructed canons and got rid of canons.
No, but what I mean by that is, if you go to any, if you go to speak in any school, as I do, you know, I go in and I'm always interested by what, how many people are doing A-levels and stuff like that. Maths is standard. Vast numbers of people now do maths in a way that they didn't 30 or 40 years ago.
But because if you can say, well, maths is great, or, you know, it'll enable you to, it's the underpinning of everything that, that makes society work. Without maths, you can't have a plane that flies or anything.
Yeah.
And then you turn around and say, well, English or history, it's all just the record of terrible,
terrible stuff. Yeah.
Well, why would you want to study it?
Well, I agree with you. I think the mood music around English and history is so negative and so freighted with kind of guilt and all these, you know, breastfeeding and stuff, that a lot of kids think, why should I do, why would I do this? It just sounds so miserable.
Exactly. It's not, and this is not a comment on whether canons are a good or a bad thing, or whether it is all just a record of depravity and evil. But if you're saying that, that's a bad pitch. If you're saying, come for 3 years and study something that's awful.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more.
If you say, come and study because it's brilliant, it's amazing, you'll read the best.
I could not agree with you more. I sometimes look at academics on Twitter and the way they talk about their own subject, and I just think,
you're not selling it.
No, you're not selling it.
You're making but then selling things is capitalism.
Well, maybe that's what they would say.
Anyway, listen, let's move on. Let's move on.
Herodotus, Tom.
He knew how to sell history.
Very, very funny comment from Beowulf. He said, this was an interesting episode, but I thought the membership of the Rest is History Club meant that I didn't have to listen to advertisements.
I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, I thought that was fun. Tom, lots of discussion about whether we were Herodotus and Thucydides. Some people were saying you were more Herodotus and I was more Thucydides.
I don't think that's true.
You don't?
No, because as I said, on the podcast, your great thing is that you're interested in all of it.
I am, yeah, I am. I'm not interested in Neanderthals or stones. I think basically I don't go back as far as you. You know, I run out of steam at about 1000 BC.
But if we knew about what Neanderthals were getting up to, the kind of cookery they did and the kind of sport they played and the kind of amusing toys they got at Christmas, you'd be all over that.
Yeah, the charts, if I could work them in.
Exactly.
If I could juxtapose the Christmas number one with some amusing fact about the budget, then I would be all over it. Yeah, I'd be all over Neanderthals, it's true. So do people still do... I mean, does that distinction between Herodotus and Thucydides still work for modern historians? Do you think deep down we're all one or the other? Like, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan said, everybody is either a little liberal or a little conservative. Do you think historians are either a little Herodotus?
I think Herodotus is completely one. I don't think that anybody sticks to political and diplomatic history anymore.
Some people do, surely.
Some people do, but they're kind of seen as, you know, retro.
Yeah, eccentrics.
Eccentrics, like the kind of people in English departments who read Beowulf. I mean, they're, you know, time's moved on. Get with the flow.
Okay.
I think the idea that, because the Thucydidean approach is founded in the idea of it being Athena-centric, it's only really about Athens.
Mm.
And Thucydides' perspective is basically Greek. He's not interested in anything that lies beyond that. He's interested in the functioning of how power works within a specifically Greek context. And our world is now, I mean, that was possible when there was a sense that, say, British history mattered enough that you could devote your entire life to studying the evolution of parliamentary norms or high politics, high diplomacy, whatever. But I think our sense of the world now is too infinite for that to have currency.
Well, all the stuff now is global. You have to
have a global perspective, but also you have to have a perspective. You have to have the women's perspective. You have to have perspective of people with a wide array of different sexual identities, all this kind of thing, all of which is there in Herodotus.
Yeah.
Because he, I think, instinctively recognizes, I mean, he doesn't formulate it in the way that Thucydides does. Thucydides basically, because he's part of the process of constructing what history will be, is saying this is what history is. But Herodotus before him is already saying, yeah, history is about war, it is about politics, but it is also about how women urinate, it is also about the kind of bongs that people in Scythia are taking, yeah. It's about all kinds of mad shit. And that, I think, is basically where we are now.
Yeah, okay.
Which is why on this podcast we have done, you know, we've done the Falklands War, but we've also done pigeons.
Yeah, they're the two poles, are they?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very
so
good.
So I would say, I think we live in a Herodotean age.
Okay. Somebody asked you about your translations. Do you feel like you're, with your translations, that you're kind of uncovering new meanings, they ask? Are you teasing out nuances that weren't in previous translations, or are you doing it for the money?
So, I'll tell you how I came to do the translation, which is, I was at a festival in the Lake District, Words by the Lakes, I think it was, or something, very good festival. And I was talking about Persian Fire. And I gave, you know, did my standard pitch. And also present was the editor of Penguin Classics, who'd come to talk about Penguin Classics. And after my talk, he came up to me and said, look, the edition of Herodotus is very old. It was done in the 50s. You know, it's not a very good translation. It's, you know, it's very readable, but it's kind of leaves a lot out. Would you like to do it? And it was a bit like the Don DeLillo White Noise, where I don't, have you read it?
Years ago.
Okay, so in that there's a guy who is professor of Hitler studies.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And his awful secret is he doesn't speak German.
Yes.
And yeah. Then he gets a message saying that his university has been chosen for the World Hitler Studies, you know, conference, yeah. and he will have to give the opening address in German, and he's thrown into panic.
Yeah.
And I felt that's exactly how I felt. I had to say, well, I never studied Greek. I mean, and I've tried to learn it. And every time I try, I give up, a bit like kind of giving up on a diet or a fitness regime or something like that. And he said, it doesn't matter. You know, you can have as long as you need to learn Greek. And I thought that's a brilliant offer. I've always wanted to learn Greek. I've never had the self-discipline to force myself to sit down and do it hour after hour after hour. Mm. And so I said, okay, yeah, I will do that. And it was like having a gun pointed at my head. So basically, that's why I did it. But also because it was Herodotus, because I knew that, you know, you can only really get to grips with an author if you read it in the original language.
Of course.
And so it was such a precious opportunity. And probably the commission for which I am most grateful. I will always be thankful for it. It was just the most brilliant experience, most kind of intellectually thrilling experience.
And didn't you do like a line a day or something like that?
No,
that
the text of Herodotus was divided in antiquity, late antiquity, into 9 books, and each book is in turn divided into kind of various sections. So maybe there might be in some books up to kind of, you know, 250 sections. And I said, I'm going to do it a section a day.
Yeah.
And so some of the sections were very short, some of them were very long. And so I had the delight, you know, if it was a kind of a single sentence, do I just bank that and then have the rest of the day off? Or do I go on and do a few more?
Right.
Great fun.
That is good fun. It's fascinating, isn't it, the whole issue of translation. I often think about this because, you know, sometimes at home we're playing a kind of parlor game of who are your top 5 writers or which are the best 5 novels or whatever. But then some of them, I'll think, you know, I don't know, Tolstoy or whatever. I mean, I've never actually read a word that Tolstoy wrote. I've read words that other people have written, translating Tolstoy, but I haven't read a word in the original language. And can you really say that you've appreciated an author if you haven't actually read?
So the book I did where I kept banging my head against this was the In the Shadow of the Sword about early Islam.
Right.
Because I didn't read Arabic. And I did briefly think, well, maybe I should try and learn it. And I got a Teach Yourself Arabic book, looked at just the letters, and I thought, I haven't got time for this. So in the end, what I had a research assistant who was a Syrian who specialized in Syriac and Hebrew. So he could, you know, he could read Arabic, classical Arabic, Syriac and Hebrew, which is really good. What I wanted.
Yeah.
So every passage of Arabic, and particularly the Quranic Arabic, he would pass it for me, and he would say, you know, this is, these are the resonances of this word. Because obviously a word doesn't have a single meaning, particularly something like the Quranic Arabic, which is so often so contested. And that was incredible. You know, I couldn't have done the book without his assistance. But even so, it was a constant criticism of mine from people who were angry about the book that, well, how can you write about this? You don't read Arabic. And it was, it hurt because there was an element of truth to it.
Right. Well, there's not much you can do about it, though. I mean, you're never going to. And I think the alternative is you just limit subjects to specialists. And you may, and sometimes the subjects need to be brought into the light by generalists, don't you think?
I think so. And I think the only thing you can do where you are writing about periods and peoples whose languages you can't read is to recognize that translations are inevitably inadequate. Yeah. And that particularly where there are key passages or key words, you have to interrogate the full range of meanings in a word.
I mean, is it the case that anybody now naturally, as it were, read or speak Quranic Arabic? Surely Arabic itself has evolved so much that...
Well, that's the hugely contested issue.
Right. Okay. Theo wants us to move on. I've actually been missing all Theo's comments, which have been increasingly...
Stop. Get
please,
on.
Please solve this problem facing British universities in the next minute or move on.
We didn't solve it, did we?
No, we didn't.
So American witches.
So James Watt, the sixth, asks the same question that you asked, actually, Malcolm McGaskill. He says, is some of the... Now, this is his question. This is not me speaking.
How, nor me.
Is some of the xenophobia, racism, bigotry, et cetera, in modern America a direct descendant of the witch paranoia of the 17th century? So he says, can you draw a straight line? Now, Tom, that's basically the question you asked Malcolm.
But I wasn't
it?
Framing it like that. I don't think that it's anything to do with racism or xenophobia. No. I mean, that they...
But the search for heretics, the obsession with the enemy within.
I think I would say the other way around, actually. I would say... the desire to be good, the desire to be virtuous, the desire to purge yourself of racism.
Is that uniquely American?
Well, Puritan is often used as a pejorative.
Yeah.
But at its heart, it's a desire to purify yourself, to be part of the elect, to be good, to be a good person. And I think that impulse is kind of there in America.
Well, it's implicit in the idea of the shining city on the hill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which lots of Americanists will say, well, we are special. We were set up as a sanctuary for people fleeing the old world and all that sort of thing. So I think it's implicit in the idea of America and of Americanness and of being American. But I agree with Malcolm that I don't think, I mean, we in Britain are just as good at hunting witches as anybody. Well, I mean, J.K. Rowling's...
It's New England, England, you know, and New England.
Yeah. J.K. Rowling's opponents are not all American, are they? I mean, there's lots within Britain. Anyway,
but to be fair, J.K. Rowling did write about witches.
Yeah, she did write about witches, it's true. Eduardo Vargas, I'm surprising we didn't mention that witchcraft was seen as superstitious until the early modern period. What caused such a shift? The wars of religion and the collapse of authority of the Catholic Church in Protestant lands? So yes, we didn't talk about why people start to believe in witches or start to hunt for witches with such enthusiasm. Well, we touched, Malcolm said, there was this new space opened up for this because of the contestation of religious authority. Do you think that's right,
Tom? Actually, it goes back further. It goes back to the 13th century, and it's part of that same swirl of anxieties and creative thinking that feeds into the Albigensian Crusade.
Right.
So that is the period when clerics and theologians and intellectuals in the upper hierarchies of the church for the first time start to think that there might be something in reports of demonic possession and witchcraft, because up to that point they had always, you know, they hadn't pursued them.
Yeah.
But even then they're very, very anxious about it. And I think it must be part of the fact that framework of authority collapses in the 16th century.
Yeah.
I mean, it is an ecumenical thing. It's one of the very few ecumenical things in the 16th century that both Catholics and Protestants are doing it. And for obvious reasons, because if you're a Catholic, how do you explain what's happened except through the triumph of Satan, the triumph of dark forces? And likewise, if you're a Protestant facing the Whore of Babylon, likewise, you're going to reach for those kind of explanations.
But also, these are periods of intense political convulsions and economic hardship, aren't they, as well? The famines,
and
inflation.
Terrible weather,
exactly. So the search for scapegoats makes sense in a way that, I mean, all periods in history see turbulence, I suppose, but it's the combination of the turbulence plus the fact that authority has broken down or has been contested that religious disagreements and religious debate and the idea of heresy and of, you know, yeah. infiltrators and apostates and things is so much in the air.
And you know, and if we attempted in the 21st century to feel superior to people in the 17th century, a few minutes on Twitter will
exactly
very rapidly yeah. cure you of any sense of superiority.
So moving swiftly on, we had an email from Antipodean Margaret, very disappointed that we didn't mention Australia in our episodes about the fall of Saigon.
So she says, when I was at university in the mid-60s, my male contemporaries lived in fear of the ballot that determined who would be conscripted to go to Vietnam and fight alongside the Americans. I think our fighting force was about 7,000, not nearly the size of the American force, but not insignificant for a country with a small population. Conscription hung over our heads as a threat to be greatly feared, and it was always a relief when a friend or relative escaped the ballot for the Vietnam War. When I first visited Vietnam in the 80s, I noted it was called the American War, an interesting little twist. We did mention Australia, didn't we, in the episode that we did on the Vietnam War itself?
With Andrew Preston. Yeah.
I think we talked about surfing.
About the Australians.
The Australians surfed.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of surfing. Yes, we did mention Australia very briefly in that, but it's true. Australia is almost always, so, I mean, I have loads of books on the Vietnam War written by American historians, and I have to say most of them don't mention Australia at all. So Australia does often get left out, and all I can say is, mea culpa on that, Margaret. You're quite right. Tom, we'll have to redress that if we ever get to Australia.
But were Australians weren't involved in the fall of Saigon?
No, I would guess. I mean, I would guess not.
Did they have an embassy? Were they helicoptered out?
They probably were. I mean, it must be the same with the British. It must be the same with all Western.
But the British were there. The British hadn't been involved.
No, but I suppose some of the Westerners, I actually don't know, Tom. I'm just speculating wildly.
Okay.
I'm guessing that some must have left. And I mean, in Cambodia, what happened? Almost everybody left, I think, didn't they?
Yeah.
The Western embassies.
Well, we don't know.
We don't know. So we're just wittering. This is just pure witter.
And so finally, Smackdowns of Empire finale. Oh, so Rome won. Oh, I am pleased.
So this is a vote on the Discord among Restless History Club members. They had a vote. They had a competition, sort of knockout rounds of the best empire, or at least, I don't know what the criteria were. It was Rome versus Britain in the final, and Rome won, I think, reasonably convincingly. And now they're doing one about Shakespeare, in which they've, I have to say, some very foolish decisions have been made. So Henry V beats Henry the Fourth.
What?
I know. That is demented.
Henry the Fourth. Oh.
Henry the Fourth is one of, first of all,
the
Henry
greatest the Fourth, plays.
Right.
Both of them.
Exactly. It's one of the absolute peaks of Shakespeare's genius. Far better than Henry V.
The perfect fusion of history, tragedy, and comedy in Henry the Fourth, Part Two.
I mean,
I know thee not, old man.
Yeah, to knock out Falstaff in
for being you.
To knock out Falstaff in round one is bonkers. I'll note two other things. There is no Antony and Cleopatra, which is mad because Antony and Cleopatra contains some of Shakespeare's finest verse, as does Richard II. Beautiful play, also not present. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going on here. But anyway,
Taming of the Shrew is, which is possibly Shakespeare's worst play.
Taming of the Shrew shouldn't be there. I mean, it's been beaten. It's been knocked out already by Midsummer Night's Dream, which is fair enough.
Fair enough. That's good.
Much Ado About Nothing has been As You Like It. I mean, it's As You Like It. It's As You Like It. Should that be there?
Yeah, As You Like It's good.
Yeah. I like Measure for Measure. Measure for Measure's not there. That's sad.
I played Lucio in Measure for Measure.
Did you?
Yeah, I was superb.
Were you?
Yeah.
I've never been in Measure for Measure, Tom. I've trod the boards as King, as Alonso in The Tempest. definitive performance.
You can imagine he was Prospero.
No, I'd be a good Prospero. But Paddy Ginn got Prospero in my school production. So that
where
was the
is
end
he
of that.
Now?
I think he joined the army, actually. I might be wrong. But
so better suited to Henry V, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, anyway, listen, I don't want to... We shouldn't be second-guessing Mr. Turner's casting choices from 1991 or whatever. But Tom, we have to go and get ready for Dublin. We will be there tomorrow. We will be doing a live show. And then, after doing our recordings in Dublin, we will have a little bit of time off before we go to do...
I've got to record my audio book.
We are going to Europe to record some episodes on location, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. In Amsterdam and in Paris.
And in Paris. And then we are going to the United States to record, not to record, to do live shows in Washington, D.C. and in New York. And we might be doing some online, some location recording then. We haven't quite decided. And Theo tells me that we have to tell you that on the evening of the 22nd of May, that is next Monday, there will be a live streamed bonus. Very exciting. I don't know what that's going to be about.
So, Dominic, how exciting it is for you that you will get to see me as much as you will over the next few weeks.
Can't wait. I actually cannot wait.
Your happy little face.
Yeah.
At seeing me yet again.
Yeah. Can't get enough of it. This is absolutely, by the way, not what I signed up for when I agreed to the podcast.
I know. But when I rang you and said, I just won't take up much time.
Yeah. You'll literally be seeing me every day of your life.
In your dreams.
Yeah. I do sometimes dream about the rest is history.
Yeah, I do as well.
But weirdly, the person that comes into my dreams is Theo. I can hear Theo's voice saying, I'll just ring Tom. I think he's on mute. There's another problem with his Wi-Fi or some such.
Or a kind of message. Okay, I think this dream has gone on long enough.
Exactly.
Can you end it in 3 minutes?
Well, that's what he's writing in the chat right now. Please wrap. Yeah, let's wrap. So on that bombshell, we will see you live. If we're not seeing you in Dublin this week, we'll be seeing you live on Monday at 8 o'clock for the live stream. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.